Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 107, where Pedro, Greta, Tom, and our special guest Jose are discussing an article by John Meyer and Brian Rowan titled Institutionalized Organizations, Formal Structure as Myth and Ceremony, published in the American Journal of Sociology in 1977. In part two, we explore the wealth of research that has followed this seminal work and the contemporary implications of institutionalization in organizational settings. If you missed part one, you can access it through our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation.
So in part one, we try to think about the key ideas of the text, and one of the things that were coming up was this potential tension on what institutions mean and how it can be related to taking for grantedness, normativity, and what it is. And I think that actually what both have in common is that this is about the accepted social order. And if one were to read in a more political, dynamic way, one would think that taking for grantedness is related to what is acceptable, which is related to a particular regime or social order. And like all social orders, there are winners and losers. There are interests in maintaining them. There are ideas that are, you know, shared and diffused by particular actors because it's serving particular purposes. So to put maybe some social context behind the emergence of a theory, it's telling, as we stopped by saying that how this was coming from a study about higher education, on how these authors were located in a very prestigious place in this ecosystem. And I think it forces us to think that take it for grantedness is important to accept, is maintained by a particular power regime in which some things get taken for granted more or less. And there are particular winners and losers and places which have the prestige and the resources to maintain particular ideas as legitimate or not.
Yeah, you're raising really good points here, Pedro. I wanted to follow up on that because I think what happened after this paper is really conceptualizing what the environment is. And, you know, I apologize in advance for continuing to hit this same hammer of environment, but the authors do have a pretty simplistic view of the environment. And I also get a little bit annoyed that they use the language of myth and ceremony in a context that is counter to drives for efficiency and effectiveness. Because if you look today, I think organizations operate in multiple environments. I think the language that we kind of agreed upon is fields. We are embedded in multiple fields that sometimes have their own myths that might be in conflict with each other. And I think especially for instance, public companies, one field where myths are introduced is that of stock shareholders that place demands on organizations for efficiency, for effectiveness, for profit, for results. And there's a whole, you know, there's an annual cycle. The value is determined by some myths, and then there is stock value. There are audits. It has its whole set of scripts or set of myths, as they use them in this paper, on its own. But it is driven to optimize the effectiveness. And when you look, what does that do within the organization? It might lead to, you know, really weird kind of policies in the organization. For instance, developing a building where you have hot desking and every department of the organization is exactly similarly laid out, stripped out of any personal cues, or, you know, nobody puts their own stuff in anymore. So it just becomes like almost like a hospital. So this is where this comes from, is a conversation with a friend of mine that said, like, you know, all these policies that HR introduces, where do they come from? Because they're not to the benefit of us. Like, if I walk through the hallways every department could be the same or the other department. I don't know anymore where I am, and it makes me wonder, who am I? So this is where I see like this going to the extreme. I'm also thinking about this trend that already started before COVID about location-independent organizations. There are no offices. So what's their environment? What do they adhere to? What are their myths and their ceremonies? And if they're less, are they then more effective, more efficient? Because that would be what Meyer and Rowan would claim, right? Based upon their paper.
I'm intrigued by the fact that Pedro wrote the topic of power, because I actually don't see that they have a power theory or that they try to explain anything from power. Actually, if anything, I feel that there's been a lot of criticism towards this particular paper, but in general institutional theory, for the fact that power is somehow absent. It should be there. Someone should explain where these institutions come from, which is the point that Gretchen was making, right? From this point, at this point in this paper, there is no such an explanation. We just know that there are things called institutions and they are in the environment, but we are not provided by a particular rationale on how they come into being. Now, later scholars, they try to provide some explanations, but you know, this tradition that Meyer and Rowan inaugurate always asks, you know, for seeking at structural and macro elements. So the way usually, let's say, these more sociological and pioneers of institutional theory would explain institutional change or institutional emergence would be by external shocks. So for instance, a crisis or structural macro processes like globalization, or it could be also the state, but the state having, you know, a change of policy, a drastic change of policy. So there's always some external element that transforms those institutions, but we don't know, we don't have the precise account of how that happened. And I actually think that problem of this origin of institutional theory that later scholars, they try to fix by also arguing that, you know, there is an element of institutional entrepreneurship or institutional work by which actors are actively maintaining and transforming these institutions. But at this point, Meyer and Rowan, I think there's an absence of explaining how power dynamics interplay in the changing of institutions.
So the same way we talked about how one can have a strategic ambiguity by design, I wonder if another reading of that is not just one of absence, but one which is based on a particular tacit view of power, right? Because I'm going to try to put what I said together with Greta said. It's interesting that you ask about the environment, and the question that you ended is, what is the environment of a location-dependent firm? Meyer has continued to do a lot of empirical work, and it's interesting, maybe we could talk about how some of the questions that are posed at the end of the paper have been answered by empirical projects that he and colleagues have led, including this whole idea of word society, which is trying to say exactly that this environment is this word society environment, and what are the trends in terms of the creative and formal organizations, what are the rules that are become taken for granted, what are the kind of characteristics that education but other fields assume. And I think the answer, which is empirically defended and interesting, is that we live in a word society system so far in which many of these things are determined. What is missing is that it's determined by whom and for what. Because again, I don't want to alarm and to be politically dramatic, but it's imperialism, another word to say word society. And what we take for granted has been through political maneuvers, through a lot of violence, but also through indirect soft ways of coercion, made the world homogeneous. And this, of course, I'm talking about the current systems we live have been created by a particular place. We can think of the US, but before there were other empires, right? So this has always been something that empires have done, from the language that is imposed on particular places, through the values that are imposed, the ways of thinking that are imposed, the imaginaries. So I think it's important to say that, again, it's not that just power is absent, but it's a tacit assumption. And if you are studying the world from the center and you assume and see, oh, how the world is becoming alike, something that is taken for granted in a particular place, right? So it is, you're talking about power, but for different ways. And I want to say that I think it's also absent given the particular analytical focus that the paper does, because as Greta was saying very well, the environment seems to be a little bit amorphous. I would say that it's interesting that in some point of the paper, they talk about the potential pluralistic nature of the environment, and there can be more than one myth, and that's of course something we see much and more today that you're referencing. But because I think they have a more static idea of the environment, they take it as, you know, they bracket it as something that is just there, and because they don't take in consideration the fact that an organization can be dealing with multiple fields or environments, that these are changing, that there is some dynamism into that, then they don't need to account for much about these issues, because the assumption is that it's just operating in a stable, continuous kind of homogeneous space. And of course, we know that especially nowadays, the environment organizations have is much more, not necessarily more dynamic, but that people have been better at recognizing the dynamism that exists and the variance and complexity and heterogeneity that exists there as well.
My take on this discussion is that there must be somewhat of a design for flexibility, because when we're talking about power, what I'm thinking of when I read some of these is I'm not just thinking of power in terms of the social and political dynamics and sort of the grand scheme of things. I'm also looking at the micro and the mundane, such as how is it that so many organizations nowadays have ditched their two-pot coffee makers for Keurigs? That's another form of institutionalization of a very mundane level, but boy, does it actually have an impact on the organization and members, because the old ones were messy. You had rules about, you know, behaviors associated with you were the last one to empty the pot, and therefore you're the one responsible, even if you're busy, to go somewhere else to go fill the pot, to now where you have K-cup dispensers and you have people buying boxes upon boxes upon boxes of flavored coffees. Everybody's got their own thing. And the cost of the average cup has gone up substantially. The power dynamic of that is kind of funny and amusing, but it's amazing how it's what it signals to others, like, for example, visitors coming into an organization who look at the old bun coffees and think that you're stuck in the 1970s. This matter of being able to apply something that is profound across a wide spectrum of possible environments, I think, is one of the things that made this, for me, an elegant layout of some interesting principles.
I think the rise of CSR departments is another good example. This is also something we've seen in the past, how many decades now? Yeah, if you think about like decoupling myth and ceremony, symbolic compliance, the whole audit culture, it's a decoupling from controlling what you do is actually what you have to do from the work at hand. So what you see is a lot of stuff that before was part of an occupation they controlled themselves is now being decoupled and externalized and institutionalized in a separate role. Sometimes that don't even know the work at hand. So how can they provide guidance on how to optimize, make the process, the work process more sustainable, or the production process? Yeah, I also felt like that is a very prominent example that we've seen like since the late 90s to now, where we've seen like all big organizations have completely institutionalized CSR departments. You don't only have financial reports every quarter, but also CSR reports, how you've done. Yeah, I thought that was also an example of that.
And this is one of the, I don't want to say breadcrumbs, but certainly threads that the paper opens. And they say exactly that future research could look at the diffusion of former organizations of specific institutions, professions, and, you know, they talk about personnel management. And of course, there's many studies about the emergence and diffusion of that, of a particular model of HR. You talk about CSR, can be things mundane, such as coffee break and the kind of technologies we use for that. So it's interesting that from this paper, there is, and I was talking about the word society idea, this whole debate about the diffusion of particular ideas have emerged And to go back to what you were saying earlier, Greta, things like agile, right? So how we can make sense of that? We can make sense of that because it's a fashion. So that's another maybe related, akin cousin idea here on how people have become interested in management fashions as a topic, because again, it's an attempt to explain how come certain models, certain ideas take such roots and diffuse so much. What is interesting to recognize, maybe just because I am in Scandinavia right now, is that besides such more traditional thread that the paper has opened, other different perspectives, and Jose was talking about this, right, on how different paradigms have been merged and meshed. And one of them is the one about Scandinavian institutionalism. We try to think of not just diffusion, but translation, and try to look at a more granular level, the changes through which practice and idea goes through in the diffusion, and how being able to go through such modifications is actually central for its ability to take over more space and be spread. So I think that there is this kind of new space created by the paper that has been further repurposed and connected with different ideas and has brought maybe better explanations. You know, I was talking about power so much, but other, maybe more mundane and general ordinary mechanisms such as fashions and perceptions that the audiences have about that, that allow us to understand how come agile, you know, is found in so many different types of industries nowadays and so on.
Speaking of fashion, I think it's interesting to think about, for example, how some institutional norms reasserted themselves after the pandemic, or at least those conversations are ongoing. You know, the dress codes and work behaviors, et cetera, that were disrupted for a period of time. And now we see that as producing a tension between those who wish things to go back to the way they were, to reassert the old institutional norms, and those who wish to sort of create new standards, new ways, new norms, and the conflict between the two. That's an interesting, for me, and a potential application.
I miss the old elbow greeting during the pandemic. We came back to the handshake. And to Tom's point, I think the handshake is so institutionalized in us that we had to get back to it. But I really appreciate that Meja and Rowan, they also set, you know, a group of propositions that later scholars would try to test. So for instance, they have one proposition. They say that environments that have institutionalized a greater number of rational myths generate more formal organizations. So the basic idea is that if there is a government agency, for instance, trying to legislate on a particular field, then there will be, you know, a bureaucracy specialized on its enforcement, and then particular offices within the organization trying to also enforce this specific myth. And I can think of two particular papers that really try to demonstrate that this is the case. One is by Tolbert and Socker in 1983. They look at the evolution of civil service in the US, and they try to explain how it got diffused by, in different cities. And when there was a mindset shift in which people understood or appreciated more the fact that you had civil career. Also, you know, they explain a bit of the battles and disputes in each city. But once you had this cultural transformation, then it's easy to see how every city starts to adopt the new civil service process. And of course, then you have specific rules that provide the details. A new whole bureaucracy is born out of this change and transformation. And a second paper that I can think of is one by Scherer in 2002. He discusses the transformation also of law firms and how they started to adopt this up or out model, in which, you know, you can only become partner otherwise you are out of the law firm and you have to go to another one. And it's interesting that this was not always the case, but the demand for more top university students, they really had to provide a way in which, you know, it was even more exclusive and the salaries were completely high. So the point that I'm trying to make is that once there is a new trend, that becomes legitimated either by their own actors or by a specific authority, then it seems that other organizations will follow suit. And to the point of Major and Rowan, it seems that this proposition that they had that a new organizational forms would emerge out of this institutional change has been tested positive by other scholars.
I think it's a great example also to show that what you said in the beginning, right? How this diffusion can be because it's tried and tested, so it makes sense cognitively to use. It's something that is, you know, associated with prestige, so people want to use because they want to be related to that. It can be many reasons, right? And I think the original paper refers to that. But what I wanted to expand a little bit more is that just to talk about the work, you know, to finish your list of examples, there's also the work of Patricia Bromley and on hyperorganization with Joe Meyer himself, right? In which they say that the very idea of an organization, this abstract notion, takes over the world. And from churches to, you know, voluntary groups, people start to understand them as a commonality set of roles that are interrelated towards a task and so on. So it's not just that elements of organization, but the very idea of organization, form organization, seems to have spread to the point that any kind of different types of aggregations of people with different purposes start to understand themselves as such. And they have done that study as well that shows that. But what I wanted to maybe expand is that another thread that Meyer and Rowan pose at the end of the paper is about this whole idea of how legitimacy is related to success and survivability. Because nowadays we have all of this interesting debate about stigma in organizations, right? And from what I understand, that idea came exactly from grappling with the fact that, well, do organizations have legitimacy? And how? And what about all of the cases in which they are stigmatized or illegitimate? And they continue to operate, and there is the work of many people. With one of the foundational papers here is the one about gay bathhouses by Gerardo Cusin and Brian Hudson. And they look exactly in trying to say, well, what is the other side of the coin, right? So I think it's also a different reading to understand, not just assuming that you need legitimacy, but how you cope with the absence of such legitimacy and manage the stigma that you may have given the particular industry, customers, products, or structures that you have in place.
I guess my not being familiar with that paper, but I wonder what legitimate according to whom? Illegitimate in one context, legitimate in another, and the legitimacy of the internal would sound like something that would ensure its survival on the basis of how it glues the membership together. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, I was going to say that there's even a third or further debate, because people that study categories and other things are concerned about audiences, right? Which is another thing that was missing a little bit than Greta was saying. What is this environment? Well, this environment means different things for different audiences. And there's all of the literature that tries to do that. So in a way, if we were to put this paper at the center, there's so many things that, you know, emerge out of some of the insights that were put forward.
Yeah, because one other thing that I had been looking at in a previous research was cases where you had organizations whose purpose for being was to attack other organizations, largely in the political discourse, where basically you have a group that's kind of sort of activist or just making noise. Basically, they have a particular target, and their legitimacy is effectively defined by how effective they are at attacking the target. There's an institutional norm that just sort of grew that defined what kind of actors these were. You would have groups form solely on the basis of an issue, make noise, but then once they get, once they cease to have an audience, they disappear. They just cease to be because there's no purpose for them to continue. So in a way, survival is not so much important for such organizations. It's really more survival long enough to be able to make a difference or have an impact on the discourse before they disappear. And then the same actors wait until some other opportunity comes up.
I think that's a brilliant issue you bring up, Tom. And that kind of shows perhaps another weakness of the paper is that it kind of black boxes organizations. It treats them all as being the same. And it also brings up the issue that all organizations are subject to a regime in a particular environment or in a particular field. And I think what you bring up is that, you know, if there are multiple fields that all have their own regimes, there are also activist organizations that just attack the regime, that attack the structures that define legitimacy and want to change it. And once they accomplish that, then they disappear again. So I think that really opens up, like, where should we position organizations? What do we see as an organization? And where are they solely, like, the manifestations of the myths and ceremonies that are seen as legitimate? And where are the ones that actively shape or try to change them?
Yeah, and to Greta's point, I think these type of readings have important practical implications in the sense that they define the strategies for organizations, but also for coalitions trying to bring some type of societal change. So for instance, now that I'm getting immersed in these different groups pushing for the four-day work week, it's really interesting to see how everyone is enacting different theoretical positions. So there are this coalition that is trying to convince managers that moving to a four-day work week is the most efficient thing to do. Their point of departure is that if we show managers that the four-day work week doesn't affect productivity and it actually reduces absenteeism and it increases employee well-being, then they will follow that new principle and this will become the new norm. But to me, it's interesting to analyze the same policy or the same attempt to bring change from an institutional perspective, because then you would be more, you know, focused on creating a new legitimacy for a new schedule or a new configuration of working time. And in that sense, a more institutional perspective, I would say, would demand or expect a more active role from the government and from legislation, because this is a way in which you can set explicitly what is the new norm that you expect other organizations to follow. Of course, it's not the only element. And I think Meja and Rowan will recognize that it's not the law enforcement by itself that creates the institution, but rather the way in which people internalize it. And, you know, even the public discussion of changing and understanding why the four-day work week might be a new policy that would benefit the overall society. But I just think it's interesting when you see these theoretical discussions getting into practice, that depending on, you know, how you understand reality and the way the world operates, you will also choose a specific strategy to try to change it.
I think one of the challenges I have with some of this is, what do we mean by efficiency? It's one of those words that I caught in the paper because it's sort of presented in one way. It's a rather amorphous concept. I find that sometimes we end up with, you know, we talk about how institutional norms may come into conflict. They can come into conflict by totally different, incompatible views of what efficiency means. You know, there's sort of like one view, which is sort of the faster, better, cheaper variety, in which you think of, if you get 2 out of 3, you're probably doing okay. And then there's the inefficiency model, which basically says efficient is no harm, no waste, and no excess overhead, like no excessive administration. And so you have some people who are trying to push for eliminating those in order to bring about efficiency. And then you have the third camp, which is allocative efficiency, which is what you run into the public sector, where from a budgetary standpoint, you're efficient if what you spent exactly provides the services that you're supposed to provide. And so what you have as resources matches exactly against outputs. What I wonder is in some ways, is that a battlefield unto itself? Because we have a lot of movements out there that are trying to bring about efficiency, but the kind of efficiency that they are bring about and try to make legitimate within an organization is in conflict with other norms that may already exist in the organization.
Which is exactly, to go back to what Greta was saying, is important to consider, right? That the organization is complex in itself. So if you were just to take about the idea of an efficiency, right, is that not only there can be competing understandings within different departments, areas, and roles about what this means, but also take the example that Jose was talking about, the four-day week, what it would mean to change the different systems inside the organization, right? The reward structures, the way that scheduling is done, the way that routines are in place, the ways that in which people plan and budget things, the way in which people match different departments' agendas across different ideas, the way holidays are set up, right? The way that HR policies are written. So it's like I'm trying to say that the complexity in the environment, the complexity in understanding, the complexity is in the institutionalized norm, but also if you look in intra-organizationally, right? Which I understand, of course, Miriam Rowe was trying to push us to see beyond the organization. There's a lot of complexity there as well. And I would even say, to go back to what you were saying in the first part in terms of formalization, form organization, it's not only that we have decoupling. I can imagine a lot of clashing across different structures, different policies, different procedures, different roles, and different understandings brought about a particular idea in different roles that would, you know, make the story even further dramatic, so to speak.
But I think precisely those points make the argument of Major and Rowan stronger, because they would agree with the fact that organizations are highly complex. And because of that, it's so difficult to even have a clear understanding of efficiency. But then that would, you know, reinforce the idea that because of that, then efficiency is not even an issue. And we might think that we are taking best practices that have been tested by experts, consultants, authority figures. But at the end of the day, we're following those principles, not because we really trust that they will bring higher efficiency, but rather because it's expected that we follow them, and we are trying to signal that, you know, we are this quality organization that has all its certifications in place, and we are trying to signal to the government that we are in compliance with the norms. So I think that the fact that they don't have a clear spelled out definition of efficiency, it's for their own purposes. So it helps their argument in saying that efficiency is really in whichever form we define it, which is also going to be different from field to field. It doesn't matter, because when an organization says that they are being efficient, what they are really saying is that they are enacting certain practices that someone else says that is efficient, but really is just bringing legitimacy.
I was kind of drawn to the statement, institutionalized organization, this is page 357. Institutionalized organizations protect their formal structures from evaluation on the basis of technical performance. And a bunch of things are given. And when you're talking, Jose, what I'm wondering is efficiency being used as a weapon to ward off, basically a defensive shield to ward off intervention?
Intervention, you mean from external parties into the organization?
Or just change, like maintain, use as a way to maintain the status quo.
I see. So you're saying that organizations follow these principles so that they don't have to constantly ask themselves what is next, or is that?
Well, not necessarily follow the principles, but what I'm saying is that sometimes they use a word as, you know, a happy sounding word as a mechanism for protection. So, you know, if they think that they're being as efficient as possible, or if they think that it'd be a way to ward off others getting involved in their business, like as a form of organizational resistance, you can throw it out there and the organization doesn't necessarily have to explain itself. It's just a value.
Nowadays, because I was wondering the same thing, it is when they talk about evaluations, right? Is that I feel that the legitimacy is harder won because it's harder for many things, and people have written about that, that it's harder to create this smoke screen to organizations because there's so much. Greta was talking about audit cultures before, right? So many rankings, so many certifications, so many ways in which you can pry open organizations and need to be made accountable. So even if not just about having a nice sounding world, there is still a lot of work in terms of communicating and trying to showcase an adherence to a particular ideal, value, form, whatever it is. And I think that the role of different evaluations, systems of accountability, whatever you want to call them, puts it in a much more contested field and in a much more effortful accomplishment than we might expect it in such context in which the paper emerged, which maybe we didn't have the internet back then. We didn't have all of the systems through which we could rank things and be subject to public opinion in such ways, right? And I think that has maybe changed the way we can think of such ideas.
Yeah, I think what Tom is also referring to is this sort of agency that perhaps we also need to train managers Like if we're living in an age where there's so many environments, so many arenas with the regimes where we have to gain legitimacy that impose rule systems or institutions on us that we have to adhere to gain legitimacy, you really have to think like, which ones do I adhere to if there are multiple conflicting rule systems even within the organization? And I think this is where the Myron Rowan piece exactly comes in, is saying that, you know, there is a risk if you adopt these myths too quickly and too often, then there can be a disconnect from the work at hand, that the rule systems and the myths in the organization, how things are done and evaluated by managers, doesn't line up anymore with the work at hand, the technologies that you use. And then even if you think like, okay, that was in 1977, now we're in 2023, and we're having all these different audiences that say, you have to do this, you have to do that. You have a line manager, you have a functional manager, you have a corporate social responsibility manager, you have an auditor, they all tell you what to do. Then we need to train these managers to really think critically, what is it that makes me do my best, my work the best? And perhaps the term efficiency is not the right term. Like I'm reading another book and that's where they say perhaps we need to think about effectiveness. Perhaps that's a more useful word to think about. You know, what are we optimizing for? But really thinking like, okay, if there are so many conflicting institutional logics, then which ones do we comply with and which ones do we decouple from?
One of the other articles that I've made a lot of use of is Christine Oliver in 1992 published an article called "The Antecedents of Deinstitutionalization," and I've used that as a basis for talking about how we as organizations stop doing things. And I think that particular article provides a good framework for thinking of the different ways of pressures to try to delegitimize an institution, because obviously there are some institutions, institutional norms that have come to exist that are really going to be hard to get rid of because it's just some of them just carry a legitimacy all their own better than others. And I think one of them is security posture, for example, the ways in which, given different threats that we've experienced in the world in the 21st century, we've institutionalized a lot of security systems into our organizations that signal that your work environment should be safe and you should be protected from harm in a way that I don't know how readily anybody would be comfortable removing those types of safeguards. But on the other hand, there are others that clearly have become dated and need to be gotten rid of. But every single institution has got equities. It's got people who are vested in some way in it. And one of the challenges that we have is, as you try to delegitimize a norm, it delegitimizes more than just the norm. It delegitimizes a whole swath of the organization that now has to figure out how to rearrange norms so that they can continue to function at the same level of legitimacy once this norm is gotten rid of. And so political pressures, social pressures, inertial pressures, there's a whole list of pressures that Oliver lays out in the article that I've had my students work through on, say, something that we say, all right, we got all this big bureaucracy. How do we get rid of it? Well, you can't just go slicing, say, all right, 15% of the headquarters goes away because that's going to make things more efficient. We have to be more thoughtful about it. And unfortunately, that's sometimes the approach we take, is just take a raw number, sharpen the axe, and just assume that things are going to work out. But it's always a lot more difficult than that.
I think we have a round circle now. We came back to power.
Or maybe can you say our final reflections on the text?
Yes, I think we can.
So my final comment is actually about ourselves, because one of the things that people sometimes ask us is, do you have a script, right? How do you make the podcast? And people are a bit surprised to say it's all, I mean, recorded live, right? So it's all arguably improvised. And I wondered myself, how come it works? I think the conversation well, and I think when I listen and I was not in an episode, or when I'm part of the conversation, that the conversation seems to be harmonious. We are taking turns. we understand the work we're going to do, even when we have guests, right, that are not even part of the podcast. And I think it's because we are all trained academics and we are familiar with the norms of a seminar, and we use such seminar norms or institution or rule-like or normative framework or take it for grantedness, whatever you want to call it, in doing this. So I think that's my own example of the power of such approach, because it explains how we're able to meet online. Some of us have never met in person. I never met Tom in person myself, and do this work because we have this rule-like framework that guides the way we are going to interact in such a space. So that is my reflection, right? Re-seeing or seeing the work in the podcast through institutional lenses. And another thing I was going to say is that, as usual, when you go back to the classic and one that has been at the root of so much further literature, is interesting to appreciate how much nuance there can be that we sometimes we miss when we just read through a particular prism or just read in a quick way and forget actually the much more heterogeneity and diversity and richness that makes this in the original text where a particular idea originated from.
I'll go ahead and follow with my final comments, because just following on with what you said about going back to the reading, it continues to amaze me how much of these original readings are memeified and they create a institutional norm all their own. So like, I'd love to go back to the discovery we had that Kurt Levine in that one episode. Just what a minor point, an insignificant point, his unfreezing, moving refreezing was. And yet that became the guiding value that drove so much organizational change literature that followed. It's interesting to see just, you know, when we sort of institutionalize an idea and the we is sort of like the body of scholars slash practitioners slash consultants, just how much the norms themselves can kind of redefine themselves and evolve over time, to the point where you come back and you're questioning what we're doing, and then you go back to the original and say, oh, wow, we really went off course somewhere. But it is so hard to go against the prevailing understandings and try to direct people back to those, because so much time has passed and some of these other interpretations have cemented themselves and institutionalized themselves into the discourse, that it's hard to go back and bring back the original ideas. That, I think, is another takeaway that I took from this. Go back to what started this institution or this norm that people are now questioning.
I think that the institutional theory has also been institutionalized in a way. And, upon Mayer and Rowan, but also other influential papers like Zucker, 1977, DiMaggio and Powell, 1983, other scholars have built upon. And they always provide their own version, their own understanding of these foundational pieces. So I also found it very refreshing to go directly to the source. One of the insights that I got, once I remember I read this paper, I remember the title, not the author, but the title of the paper is Why Institutional Theory Cannot Be Critical. And the main point of discussion was this argument that we brought to the podcast of why is power absent, or maybe, as Pedro would say, tacit in this paper, by not really discussing how these institutions come into being, who decides what is institutionalized or not. I kept this impression that Mayer and Rowan didn't have a critical element in their paper, because it's a way in which you can justify the status quo, the way in which you explain stability and perdurance of certain practices, but there is no a way in which you can react to change or to provide an explanation of how to transform reality. However, I found a critical element, which is by reflecting upon the category of efficiency, they are trying to say, don't believe whomever tells you that they have the magic way to become efficient in your organization. Be a bit skeptical, because that understanding of efficiency might be legitimized by a specific authority. But more than that, it is an institution in itself. So it doesn't necessarily mean that it provides the benefits that it claims. It only means that everyone is doing it, the environment is, you know, okay with it, and there is a social expectation that you will follow that same dictum. So to me, this is a critical component, because now every time that I see someone claiming that they found a more efficient way, for instance, to arrange working time, whatever, I'm very skeptical. And this happened to me in the discussion of the four-day work week, when I actually went to see the reports. For instance, the way they were measuring efficiency was through surveys. So they would ask the manager after the implementation of the pilot, do you think your organization is more efficient? Or they would ask employees, but there's, you know, this also element of everyone being excited about working for 4 days a week. So, of course, you have a lot of incentives to maybe overestimate the effects. And it's just the personal element, right? Like, we don't have objective measurements for influence of efficiency on this working time arrangement. So what I'm trying to make is, I think by reading this paper now, I'm more skeptical and hesitant to take any kind of standard that tells me that, you know, efficiency would be improved if you cut down hours or if you cut down workers from a firm. I think we should always keep that in mind, perhaps.
Yeah, I have a very short takeaway. That it makes much sense to me to view it as a process, institutionalization. We introduced a whole additional vocabulary beyond what's introduced in this paper to talk about processes of institutionalization. And that helps me to get into institutional theory, which I've always had a bit of an aversion to in grad school.
We thank our special guest, Jose Gallegos, for joining us in this episode. And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.